you have it online if you didn't come or if you want to watch it again. I'm going to be reading from three books.
Books.
Me quedo aquí parado, ¿no? Porque este no va, ¿no? Vale, me quedaré aquí sentado toda la clase. No soy muy de andar, pero me contendré. Okay, so as I was saying, normally I do read from several books as a way of bringing you other points of view and doing part of the groundwork that I know when you're studying several subjects at the same time, it's very difficult to cope with going to the secondary bibliographies and at least reading those messages and seeing if, hey, I would like to know more about that. But there's so many sources of information. If we go, for example, to the last slide where I have the sources of the online resources, I brought, it's not the Cambridge Companion, but this is a Cambridge introduction. Cambridge has two types of critical collections. They have introduction books that are very good for initial essays, and it contextualizes the work, the life, the reception. It's a really interesting book. Normally, it's in the central library for each of the main authors in the book. There must be 20 out of the 24 authors that we have either have this Cambridge introduction, just like I picked it up this morning, or they have the Cambridge Companion. So the Cambridge Companion is more a collection of critical essays. The Cambridge introduction, a sort of compiled essay to know more about the author. So if you feel that for whatever reason you want to extend on the information on that author in particular, I'm going to read a bit from the beginning of this book today, the beginning of the class, and the importance that from Puritanism to Postmodernism gives to Edgar Allan Poe is significant. So I'm also going to read Poe as a way of counterposing Poe's work to the work of Emerson, something that we've already spoken about, the importance Emerson has for the entire Romantic movement, and how there is a sharp contrast between what transcendentalism represents and what the rest of the Romantic movement, especially in particular these three authors, Herman Melville, Nathaniel Hawthorne, that also lived in Concord, we could say adopted Concordians, coexisted in time with Edgar Allan Poe, whose demise was in 1849, if I'm not mistaken. So why are we studying Edgar Allan Poe after studying Nathaniel Hawthorne and Melville, which published their work after or reached the pinnacle of their work afterwards? I really don't know. I don't know if it would make more sense to probably study Poe in the first place and afterwards study Nathaniel Hawthorne and Melville. But there is a sense when you study it in the order that Professor G. Redd selected of crescendo in terms of significance. We talked about the overall significance that Nathaniel Hawthorne had for American literature, how he's considered the darkest of this triumvirate of romantics. Melville feeds on that darkness and improves his work through his interaction with Nathaniel Hawthorne. So it does make sense to raise a bar and go from Nathaniel Hawthorne's very relevant Scarlet Letter to Moby Dick as the pinnacle of American literature. And probably if we talk about Edgar Allan Poe, it is no coincidence that whenever you've seen this presentation at the beginning of a class, you could probably only recognize one picture. There was only one picture there that stood out, and you could probably say, I probably own a t-shirt of this guy, or I have it on a notebook. And this is part of what we're going to study today, why Edgar Allan Poe is more of a figure of legend and a figure of romantic admiration, not only based on his work, but on everything he represents, the mystery, the lack of knowledge about the details of his life. And that's basically how legends are born, when a character has been analyzed to the smallest of the details about his life, Normally, the legend around the figure fades away. And in this semester, we have two very significant cases, Edgar Allan Poe and Emily Dickinson, where the legend extends beyond the literary persona, because there are so many things that we don't know about Edgar Allan Poe that make the entire concept of Poe all the more interesting. Edgar Allan Poe had terrible press during his lifetime, and after his death, he was crucified by his own publishers after dying. So his reputation was the worst reputation possible that an author could achieve. So far from receiving recognition, today we're going to travel through a purely romantic story of doom and perdition from the personal point of view, from the passenger seats, and with some elements of the biography that will make us cringe and remind us to other artists or other relevant figures with doubtful life choices. He married a cousin of his at a very, very early age, her age, led a life that can only be categorized as unusual at the best and indecent for the standards of the time. So without further ado, and with this, I don't know if boastful presentation. Let's start with this presentation. I've already added to this presentation the change in our timeline. Next week we're going to cover Longfellow, and then we'll go on to study Frederick Douglass, Harriet Beecher Stowe, and Walt Whitman before we hit the Easter break. After the Easter break, we're going to come back with Emily Dickinson. It's slightly unfortunate that we're not able to study Walt Whitman and Emily Dickinson on back-to-back weeks, but that's the way that the course is divided. And something very interesting, I think that from all these authors, all the authors that we have, there is a new biography about Frederick Douglass that comes to flip the many of the concepts that exist about the person. I had the opportunity of purchasing this biography a couple of months ago. I haven't had the opportunity to read it yet. It's on my night table, glaring at me. But I will hardly refer to it. I'll bring it to class that day, so you can page through it. It's a winner of this year's Pulitzer Prize. So it must be a very good piece of work. I'm looking forward to having some time this summer to read it. Going back to Edgar Allan Poe, words have no power to impress the mind without the exquisite horror of their reality. There are several things in this quote by Edgar Allan Poe which belongs to the work of prose that we're going to read today. And in the case of Edgar Allan Poe, we have two sides that are equally important. His facet or his persona or his capacity as a poet and his capacity as a storyteller. We should also add a third branch to that sets of skills: his capacity as a critical analyst, as a critic, and applying something that would afterwards, one century later, become the de facto standard: close analysis. Edgar Allan Poe is considered by many to be the pioneer in close analysis, and in this way that we have nowadays of reading books where we focus very much on certain passages of the book and come to conclusions that might change the entire significance that we apply to a story, and that has been so important for movements such as post-structuralism, new historicism, feminism, or post-modernist studies. What other things can we extract from this quote? And it's not a lot of information that we have here. The first one is that Poe has a likening for the grotesque, for the unusual, and for terror. So his view of romanticism takes romanticism to new heights or to new lows. I wouldn't know how to classify that very well, but most definitely he's going to be the most extreme of this romantic trio that we've been talking about, this threesome of darkness that Hawthorne, Melville, and Poe represent. As you can see, he led not a very long life. He lived to the age of 40. He died right before what is considered the pinnacle or the golden period of romanticism, the year 1850, where The Scarlet Letter was published 1 year before Moby Dick was published, and therefore he precedes most of the important works that would succeed him in life. But he laid the foundation not only for American romanticism, but for a universal way of interpreting a movement that he embodied in his entire work that is called aestheticism. Aestheticism works under the paradigm, has the motto of art for art's sake. You've probably heard that quote a million times. And Edgar Allan Poe represents and is the literary embodiment of aestheticism, and is a huge example for a group, a very significant group of French authors, Baudelaire and others, that saw in Edgar Allan Poe the roots upon which to found the symbolist movement. Symbolism relies on Edgar Allan Poe as the reference, the key reference for inspiration, and it is very interesting to see how, while Emerson was the most highly considered author, Edgar Allan Poe's view of beauty has exactly nothing to do with the view that Emerson has. Emerson believed that beauty and the truth were connected and walked hand by hand. If you were able to interpret nature, if you were able to unlock the keys of nature, unlock the keys of the harmony in the world that surrounds us, you would be able to reach the truth. What Puritans regarded as a didactic purpose. We're writing for a reason. We're writing to teach to future generations the important things of life that we've discovered. And Edgar Allan Poe says there's no important things in life. We write because it's beautiful. And we write because writing justifies writing. And I don't have to look for another point of view besides making a good work to justify the work that I create. So if you remember, for example, the Dead Poets Society and Robin Williams' famous quote, "Why we write poetry, we write poetry," and he goes on to cite Whitman, that would connect directly with the philosophy that Edgar Allan Poe had. We write because it's beautiful to write, and the beauty of the art is the justification for art, art for art's sake. It comes to melt down into the same idea. And for him, beauty was a much wider concept than the narrow concept that we normally understand as beauty. For him, terror was beauty. Death was beauty. Crime was beauty. Human fault was beauty. Please. The sublime and the opposite of the sublime. It's more about the creation, the creative process, and the way that using the observation of the world as a way of creating art. What Edgar Allan Poe would consider art. Everything that is art is beautiful in his words, and everything that is beautiful at the same time expands way beyond what other artists or other philosophers or thinkers held as beauty. For sure, the transcendentalists had a very clear view of beauty. Beauty was the untouched nature, the wilderness, connecting with the world, understanding the natural rhythm of the world, being conservationist, preserving the purity of ideas. For Edgar Allan Poe, beauty is to describe a crime. Beauty is to are the dead people. Beauty is the plague. Beauty can be a raven that is asking you questions and interacting with the poetic persona. Today we're going to read two stories that help us understand Edgar Allan Poe, I think more on the side of the poet than on the side of the storyteller. The story that we're going to read is one of the lesser known stories. I think that there are other stories that you might be more familiar with, because Edgar Allan Poe is surprisingly an author that is read in a contemporary manner very, very frequently and by people of all ages. It's a typical book that has an appeal for teenagers, has an appeal for adults, has an appeal for crime lovers, has an appeal for people that love poetry. Everybody finds something in Edgar Allan Poe, and I think that's because his work at the same time is much more stripped of the dark of the entanglements that you find in Melville and in Hawthorne. That's sometimes so difficult to understand because it's so multi-layered, it's so archaic, it's so profound that sometimes readers get lost. In Edgar Allan Poe, you understand the story, and the stories have a universal feel. They have such a universal feel that Edgar Allan Poe has been considered to be the inventor of the detective story, the confessional crime story, the core source of inspiration for the symbolist, to have inaugurated many genres or many subgenres that basically have to do with terror, with mystery, with crime, with confession, with guilt. In that sense, he is a writer that has a position on his own, even though we've come to analyze him within a global whole of a set of writers that we can find easy connections, because one of your tasks as scholars is going to be to compare and contrast him with others. Can we compare him easily? Yes, we can compare him super easily. We compare him to Emerson, therefore we can compare him to Thoreau from the point of view of the contrast. We can compare him to Hawthorne and Melville for sure, both on what makes them similar and on what makes them different. That's a good thing about Edgar Allan Poe, that he's so singular that it's very easy to draw the connections and also to draw the differences. I can find similarities to the poetry of Walt Whitman in the sense of the length, but at the same time, in the choice of the point of view, I can find similarities to the poetry of Dickens. In prose, you can find similarities to from Washington Irving to Melville to Hawthorne. We have another dimension of author. That's one of the things that I want you to walk away with today. That it's a really important and a really significant writer, and it's no wonder that he's a writer that has been celebrated and enjoyed by generations of readers, except probably for the generation within which he lived. He was almost forgotten in time, and was only recovered for the readership during the first half of the 20th century. So almost half a century had to go by before he was reinstated as an important member of the American Literary Canon. Hi, Constance. If you have any questions, let me know. I'm sitting down because the microphone doesn't work, and this is the only way you're going to hear me. The objectives of the unit, as usual, I take them from the study guide. In this unit in particular, there is besides the study guide, besides the points that we talked about, something that was the topic of a pact a couple of years ago, the unity of effect. What does the unity of effect mean? And it's a really interesting read. It goes a bit beyond what we have time to do in this unit, but it comes to help us understand how the short story that we're going to read today, The Mask of Red Death, how the entire story has an effect on the reader, and how until the very end of the story you're not able to create a full understanding of the story, and how that unity of effect, something that is very characteristic of Edgar Allan Poe, is an important element in his work. That final hit, that punchline, that punch to the stomach, or as another way of seeing it. We're going to talk about the principles of aestheticism, art for art's sake. We're going to extend on the idea of how Poe's popularity went well into the 20th century and has surely reached our time. I think it's probably the only writer of 19th century American literature that is recognizable by name by the majority of readers of other languages other than English. That comes to say things about how his message has this universal, which is a dangerous word to use, touch, and how significant his contribution to literature was. He's considered the father of the Gothic horror story. Thanks to Poe, there are two elements that are taken, I think, from Sir Walter Scott. I don't remember exactly if it's from Walter Scott, but I think it is. The two elements, grotesque and arabesque, are not his. But he did make them popular. He categorized his fiction in grotesque as those that emphasize on the disharmony of the world, and the arabesque, where the narrative has a conclusive or a purpose of leading the reader towards an effect of terror. We're going to see how Poe does something that is rather remarkable, because he is probably considered the prime example of Gothic, but he always used Gothic as a way of satirizing the genre. So he actually uses the genre as a way of mocking the genre itself. However, he's become the biggest example or the biggest name that comes to mind when we think about the term Gothic. He did use the Gothic fiction as a satirized framework, and as Melville and Hawthorne, he has this allegorical touch, this allegorical feature that is also parodied. This is a period that I think that you've already perceived, that there is a tremendous amount, these three authors, of disillusionment with the entire generation or feel or sentiment of the world, and far from hiding it, they use the same framework of the society they belong to, this still very conservative, very religious America, to mock it, parodying the biggest the figure of representation of Puritan narrative, the allegory, using it with a certain twist of mockery. The Mask of Red Death is an aesthetic fable about art and nature, and comes to contradict everything that we could, every conclusion that we might make about Emerson and his view of nature, and how happiness and harmony for humans was entering contacting or be staying in touch with nature. Edgar Allan Poe reminds us in a period I think is more significant than ever, how it's very, very difficult to run away from disease, and no matter how many barriers, artificial or not, you try to put in their way, if a disease has to come, it will come, and it will find a way to get into our lives. Interestingly enough, these days it seems more current than ever. The idea of the unity of effect or the unity of impression is a concept that Edgar Allan Poe relies on that creates an enveloping effect that makes it absolutely necessary to understand the entire story in order to reach the climax of the story at the very end. So the entire story, from the very first line to the end of the story, is necessary to understand the underlying message that you may come to, and that, funnily enough, is never going to be clear. Because if anything is clear about Edgar Allan Poe, is that his main purpose is to create ambiguous endings and ambiguous interpretations. He doesn't want closure. He wants everything except closure. And in the same way that we've already seen this with Hawthorne and with Melville, how the typical determined ending that other authors, pre-romantic and proto-romantic, gave us, these authors, very much in the likening of modernism and postmodernism, are going to run away. They're going to go in a divergent direction to closure. They're going to offer us ambiguity and open endings. Even though there is this unity of effect or impression, each of us are going to come to conclusions that might seem contradicting. And maybe the interpretation that one of you have about the story contradicts the interpretation that another reader has. And that's okay, because nobody can tell you that your interpretation is better or worse than other interpretations. Before I read from those notes about his biography, let me read a page and a half from the Cambridge Introduction to Edgar Allan Poe. I like the way it's written. The first chapter is devoted to his life, and I think it comes to help us understand our current appreciation of Edgar Allan Poe. What has been termed the enigma of Edgar Allan Poe remains very much with us, even though he died in 1849. Some aspects of this enigma, which amount to slanting the truth or to outright lies, originated with Poe himself. Others were supplied by persons who knew him, by others who supposed that they knew about his personal circumstance and career, or by still others who falsified the record because they took suspect facts at face value. Consequently, a Poe legend emerged which retains widespread currency today. One may not exaggerate in remarking that a biography, brief or lengthy, of Poe is published nearly every year, although exceedingly few facts about his life and career have been discovered since the late 1930s or early 1940s, and much must remain speculative about that life. The most reliable biography continues to be Arthur H. Quinn's Edgar Allan Poe, A Critical Biography, which dates from 1941, but which, as a factual narrative, accounts of Poe's life maintains its value. An introductory book about Poe, such as this, requires sensible biographical treatment. Much in his life was anything but sensational. More often, it became downright grudging, but drudgery did not suppress or distort Poe's amazing creativity. whether personal circumstances provided the mainspring in his creativity may, however, be questionable. Poe is often associated with the South because he spent most of his first 20 years in and around Richmond, Virginia. He was born, though, in Boston, Massachusetts, 7th of October, 1809, because his parents, David Poe Jr. and Elizabeth Arnold Hopkins Poe, an emigrant from Great Britain, were traveling stage actors who happened to be working in Boston when Edgar was born. I'm not going to continue reading because it's really interesting, but it's very extensive, and we don't have time. We have to focus on the work more than on the biography. As you can see, everything about Poe's life seems like movie material. It's fascinating, and at the same time, dark and unresolved. He was the second son of teenage traveling actors, and therefore a very clear candidate to being abandoned at an early life, as happened to him. His father had a bohemian lifestyle and very quickly abandoned Edgar when their mother died. Each of the orphans went to different families. The name of Edgar actually comes from his adoptive parents. He was raised by John Allen, a wealthy tobacco merchant, and his wife. And what you see is the typical story of a teenage dispute that you would find in many cases, but with an adoptive parent, that was therefore maybe a more difficult situation. He received an education in Virginia, where he resided, being born in Boston is actually a matter of chance. But there are connections to his life in different parts of America. I don't know if you know this, but Edgar Allan Poe is the only artist creator that I can think of that has a professional sports team named in his honor. The Baltimore Ravens, a football team, a quite good one in fact, are named after Edgar Allan Poe's Raven that we will have the opportunity to read today. And it just goes to show how significant the current popularity that he has, despite his humble origin and his humble upbringing. He was not a good student. He dropped out after a few months, and death is a very recurrent and a very traumatic experience that appears in his life time after time after time, and especially in the form of the women that were closer to his life. He endured the death of his foster mother, his mother, and his wife Virginia. In the case of Virginia, he had very dodgy relationships, and was considered to lead a life that was far from what would be considered respectable. He seemed to have this is not the a single case in literature, several relationships, and you never know if it's part of the slandering that happened after his death, but he was always considered to do most of his poetic work as a way of conquering prostitutes and entertaining his numerous lovers. I think the presentation that says that there's a fourth entangled relationship. Biographies tend to be divergent there. But again, I think that in cases where there are so many holes in the biography, we should stick to what is significant for his literary persona. What we see very clear is how important death is, because it is very close to him, and at the same time, foster father son relationship. There is never a single father figure in any of his stories. None. You cannot find a father figure in any of his stories, and that doesn't seem a coincidence. He considered his father, his foster father, to be cruel and cheap, and they clashed because of Edgar's difficult, I guess, personality, and because of his literary aspirations. He fled to Boston to publish his first book of poetry at age 22. So that means that Edgar Allan Poe's initial reputation is based on his poetry. And even though he was successful from the point of view of being read, he never entered or accessed any wealth due to his work. Probably because his idea of art for art's sake seems kind of contradictory with wanting to rake in big amounts of money for his work. So he probably wasn't the most practical person in the world. He happened to marry a cousin, and if that isn't shocking enough, a cousin was 13 years old in 1835. Wife, Virginia Clement, died of tuberculosis at age 25, and many of the female figures that have tragic endings in Edgar Allan Poe's the story have a clear reference or are clear revisitings of this case, and we can cite many examples both in his poetry and in his prose of iterations of the figure of Virginia Clement. Poe died in Baltimore, and that's the only thing that is clear. How did he die? No one knows. I've only written some of the causes that I found reading different sources. Some have attributed it to alcohol, brain congestion, cholera, drugs, heart disease, rabies, suicide, tuberculosis, shingles, syphilis, anything that you can imagine that is not good and frequent in the worst circles of the period, is normally cited in some place as a possible cause. The most commonly mentioned is tuberculosis, even though the way that he died, the way that he was found dead, is kind of difficult to connect with tuberculosis, because he disappeared. He was reported disappeared. He appeared the next day dead, and he was wearing different clothes from the moment that he disappeared. And he appeared on the side of a road in front of a tavern. So who knows? The thing is that he died, and I think that's the loss. The loss is all the Edgar Allan Poe that was yet to be published, yet to be written, yet to be enjoyed. In the case of Edgar Allan Poe, we have a very, very strong body of work that is developed only over the course of 18 years. And we're going to see authors that have this frenetic type of production. We've already seen in the case of Nathaniel Hawthorne, but that have a tragic death. For example, the last author that we read in this course, Stephen Crane, we also have the feeling that only death separated us from many other works of art, and in the case of Edgar Allan Poe, it's clearly the case. Before I read from his works, let me quickly read some passages from Edgar Allan Poe that the authors provide a lot of importance in this book that I think is seminal to understanding American literature as a whole. Today is clear to us that one essential service Emerson performed for America or for American writing was to release the power of symbolism and thereby transform much subsequent thought and poetry. But he was not the only poetic revolutionary of his time to perform that task, nor was his the only way to perform it. When the French symbolist poets of the middle and later century discovered an American source for their sense of art's power, it was not to Emerson they looked, but to Edgar Allan Poe, a writer for whom nature provided none of the emblematic security Emerson could find in it. I think that's very interesting. For Emerson, nature is a return to security. For Poe, it's a way of accessing danger and the unknown, normally not with a good ending. What to Emerson gave order, to Poe gave disorder. Where Emerson discerned over soul or cosmic force, Poe saw a more thanatogenic entity, an elusive beauty, a never-to-be-imparted secret whose attainment is destruction. If Emerson was the affirmative, Poe was the decadent imagination. Poetry led not to Orphic truth, new light and power, but into the inverted, labyrinthine world of the imagination, which disinvests the concrete world of its materiality, while offering no secure and redemptive mystery beyond. From the start, the optimism of American transcendentalist symbolism had its inversion in a poet who suffered neglect and abuse in his lifetime, and after it, whose voice has always seemed not only perverse, but frequently insecure, yet whose importance is now quite unmistakable. As time has settled, as the dust of time settles, the greater writers emerge. And even though we are studying 24 authors in this set of very significant literature, the names that emerge as universal are very few. And I've tried to convince you over the course of a couple of months that Emerson had an importance. But you have to believe me, or you have to read and come to that conclusion. But I don't have to convince you of the importance of Poe, because you've already probably reached the importance of Poe before reaching this course. And that's probably the biggest element that attains for the importance that Poe has himself. He exceeds the limits or the constraints of the scholar world, of the world of the understanding between the lines. His message is so clear that it transcends time and it transcends generations. It's probably more transcendental than the transcendentalists themselves. Going back to the poetic principle from The Poetic Principle, published in 1850, 1 year after his tragically death by Poe, summed up the principles of his entire writing life. They were symbolist principles. We have taken, and this is Poe talking in his work, The Poetic Principle, we have taken it into our heads that to write the poem simply for the poem's sake, and to acknowledge such to have been our design, would be to confess ourselves radically wanting the true poetic dignity and force. But the simple fact is that would we but permit ourselves to look into our souls, we should immediately there discover that under the sun there neither exists nor can exist any work more thoroughly dignified, more supremely noble than this very poem. This poem per se, this poem which is a poem and nothing more. This poem written solely for the poem's sake. So this idea of the sake of the poem, the sake of the art, is what differentiates Poe from from at least all the transcendentalists and most of the writers of the time and the sentiment of the time. He did not try to impose his point of view on the world and to impose any type of learning from a poem. You arrive to art to enjoy the art, not to learn from the art. If any lesson was extracted, was the own beauty of the poem. Poetic meaning is located in the poem's own composition and utterance, not in the exterior referential truth. In this, Poe was wholly out of tune with New England. He did not share the epical notes. The truth is that I am heartily sick of this life and of the 19th century in general, says Edgar Allan Poe. And he certainly did not share what he called its heresy of the didactic. The idea of the didactic, he considered it to be heretic because it was like conning the readers into believing that the art was more important than it actually was. It was just art. And that's how you should read it. What was the reaction? Neither Emerson nor the schoolroom poets, we'll get into that next week, who they were, could accept Poe's counter thesis, the fundamental incompatibility between beauty and truth. And I think that's a key phrase, incompatibility between beauty and truth. For Poe, they're absolutely incompatible. For Emerson and the sentiment of the time, they were the path. The path to beauty was the path to truth. And that's as opposed as two schools of thought can ever be. Poe began his career with poetry. His sure voice and insistent theme, the systematic search for a supernatural beauty, lying both beyond and at odds with the phenomenal or noumenal world, is clear. And we're going to read today The Raven. The Raven is one of the most read poems in English, at least. And it's as read as it is parodied. And the funny thing is that at the same time, The Raven itself is a parody because it imitates another poem pre-existent to Poe's from another artist. And he just liked the musicality of the poem so much that he used the same musicality in The Raven. So, despite how wonderful we might come to believe that The Raven is, it is by no means an original poem. It's a poem that uses principles and styles that were already existing. And that's something that we're going to see how Poe does in a very singular way. He doesn't try to hide that he's original and the only person that sees the truth. He knows that he's picking from here and there. Going back to the presentation, Poe as an author is probably America's most original, disturbing, and powerful writing. Much more interested in aesthetics than in ethics. Absolutely not interested in ethics, as you will be able to read in the short story. More interested in cultivating beauty than in teaching morality, which is contradicting with all the Puritan tradition, and of course with the tenets of transcendentalism. I said there are no father figures in Poe's tale. Well, there are barely any parents at all, and it is not a coincidence. When Poe creates a story, he has an intentional search for the eccentric and the extravagant. It's not that he arrives there by chance. He's looking for them at the core of his story. Simplicity was not synonymous with good taste. You will see that his stories are not difficult to capture, and they seem to have a simple style, but by no means are they simple in fabrication. And excess, this is probably the first author in American literature where we see that excess is a very valid adjective to categorize his work, is by no means proof of bad taste. And we're going to see how his stories, his examples, his points of view are excessive in many aspects of of crossing red lines that other authors have not dared to cross, or in exceeding, in being excessively repetitive at certain points. He didn't believe in the boundaries that literature had told him to, that had to be preserved. Poetic beauty, in his opinion, has, this is a really interesting a sentence, the quality of strangeness. And poetry gives pleasure precisely because it's difficult to determine and to signify. Many of the of the students of this introductory course to American poetry sometimes are a bit overwhelmed by the amount of poets and the variety of poets and how to come to meaningful conclusions. Poe's point of view was basically that there were no meaningful conclusions to arrive to. So you had to enjoy the poem because the poem was enjoyable for no other reason. And if you didn't, well, it was probably more a problem of the poem than a problem of the reader. And he understood beauty as something that exists implicitly in poetry. art is an end, not a means. And when authors like Baudelaire read Edgar Allan Poe, they refer to feeling a strange commotion, and that is something that is very characteristic. Some short stories from Edgar Allan Poe have been said to create reactions that are very similar to H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds, and how they were disturbing for a time. I find it hard to believe, but that's part of Poe's legend. You never know where to discern what was true and what has been manipulated and fabricated over time. Poe's experimental theories, he was a magnificent theorist and critic, besides a poet and writer. And I think that that's probably Poe's lesser known side. His importance as a critic has been repeatedly acclaimed. I'm losing my voice. I'm trying to talk so loud. Well, if I don't die trying to, I'm going to read, before we continue, the Raven. I really think I can't read the Raven. I don't know if that's going to worsen it. Okay, well, the Raven, we can read the Raven on page 299. It starts the information about the Raven. I'm quickly going to jump to the part where we talk about the Raven. I think that's slide 12. Or this is slide 7, yeah, slide 12. There are several versions of the Raven. The one we have is the 1845 final version. There are versions as early as 1842. I've already said that the Raven is not an original structure of Edgar Allan Poe. I would ask you as an interesting source of secondary knowledge to look at the more celebrated poems of Elizabeth Barrett Browning, and you will find that several of her poems have repetitive structures that are very similar to the Raven, and some seem direct mirrors upon which to base the structure of the Raven. It was Poe's first great success as a poet, and suddenly and transformed him overnight into a superstar, a celebrity. No poem in America has ever been so popular, even though I think that probably in the collective memory of Americans, some poems are more celebrated than the Raven. The Raven has always maintained its air of a bizarre poem that is beautiful, but at the same time disturbing, almost mocking and parodic at the same time as able to create an atmosphere of awe and mystery. The Raven, as you can read there, can be seen as grief entering his life to never leave again. And that's the symbolism that we can come to the conclusion reading the poem. You could come to another conclusion, and Poe would be fine about that. When Poe was composing the Raven, he was conscious that it was more of elaborating or fabricating a poem, and he applied an almost mathematical method of calculation to create the structure and to make it as significant as it is. And you'll understand why we're talking so much about a poem before reading it, because it's really an unusual poem, and it has a structure that you probably haven't read many poems that are similar to this one. There is a specific reference to the loss of a deaf beloved person that we can come to understand as the death of someone in Poe's life. The stanzas are rather unusual. They're formed by five lines of octameters and heptameters that alternate with short verses of seven syllables and tetrameters. The rhyme scheme is also unusual. It's an A, B, C, B, 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 with a repeated B throughout the poem. And you can see that this B is not only going to be alliterative and constant, it's going to be like a pounding sound throughout the poem. The poem is highly musical, but at the same time, it's very curious and unusual in terms of how repetitive the rhyming is. The trochee, which is the opposite stress pattern to the I am, that is how we've seen the majority of the poems that we've worked with in this course, follows the opposite structure in each foot of a stressed syllable and an unstressed syllable. So it makes it more difficult to choose the words. And as I said before, there's a lot of internal rhyme, onomatopoeia, alliteration, and assonance in the structure. This is probably our first taste of everything that is to come in terms of poetry. It is going to be both beautiful but very elaborate, and a poem that you can see that is not being written in one single rapt of inspiration where the poet just comes to write. These are poems that are created over the course of many years, in many cases. Let me read from the beginning, page 300, The Raven, as long as a poem can get. Once upon a midnight dreary, while I pondered weak and weary over many a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore, while I nodded nearly napping, suddenly there came a tapping as of someone gently rapping at my chamber door. 'Tis some visitor, I muttered, tapping at my chamber door, only this and nothing more. Ah, distinctly I remember, it was in the bleak December, and its separate dying ember wrought its ghost upon the floor. Eagerly I wished the morrow, vainly I had sought to borrow from my books surcease of sorrow, sorrow for the lost Lenore, for the rare and radiant maiden whom the angels named Lenore, nameless here forevermore. And the silken, sad, and certain rustling of each purple curtain thrilled me, filled me with fantastic terrors never felt before. So that now to still the beating of my heart I stood repeating, 'tis some visitor entreating entrance at my chamber door, some late visitor entreating entrance at my chamber door, This is it and nothing more. Presently, my soul grew stronger, hesitating, then no longer. Sir, said I, or madam, truly, your forgiveness I implore. But the fact is I was napping, answer gently you came rapping, answer faintly you came tapping, tapping at my chamber door. That I scarce was sure I heard you, here I opened wide the door, darkness there and nothing more. And if you notice that at the beginning of each stanza, there's like a peak in the intonation, and it ends like in a wane. It's like softly, it goes away. The last verse is read as if preparing for the next climax. Deep into the darkness peering, long I stood there wondering, fearing, doubting, dreaming dreams no mortal ever dared to dream before. But the silence was unbroken, and the stillness gave no token, and the only word there spoken was the whispered word, Lenore. This I whispered, and an echo murmured back the word, Lenore. Merely this, and nothing more. Back into the chamber turning, all my soul within me burning. Soon again I heard a tapping, somewhat louder than before. Surely, said I, surely that is something at my window's lattice. Let me see then what threat is, and this mystery explore. Let my heart be still a moment, and this mystery explore. 'Tis the wind and nothing more. Open here I flung the shutter, when with many a flirt and flutter, in there stepped a stately raven of the saintly days of yore. Not the last obeisance made he, not an instant stopped or stayed here, but with mane or lord or of lord or lady, perched above my chamber door, perched upon a bust of Pallas, just above my chamber door, perched and sat and nothing more. Then this ebony bird beguiling my sad fancy into smiling by the grave and stern decorum of the countenance it wore. Though thy crest be shorn and shaven, though I said art sir no craven, ghastly grim and ancient raven wandering from the nightly shore, tell me what thy lordly name is on the night's Crotonian shore, quoth the raven, nevermore. Much are I marvel this ungainly, foul to hear discourse so plainly, though its answer little meaning, little relevancy bore. For we cannot help agreeing that no living human being ever yet was blessed with seeing bird above this chamber door. Bird or beast upon the sculptured bust above his chamber door with such name as nevermore. But the raven sitting lonely on that placid bust spoke only that one word, as if his soul in that one word he did outpour. Nothing farther than he uttered, not a feather that he fluttered, till I scarcely more than muttered, other friends have flown before. On the morrow he will leave me, as my hopes have flown before. Then the bird said, nevermore. Startled at the stillness broken by reply so aptly spoken, doubtless said I, what it utters is its only stock and store, caught from some unhappy master, whom unmerciful disaster followed fast and followed faster, till his songs one burden bore, till the dirges of his hope the melancholy burden bore of never, nevermore. But the raven still beguiling all my sad soul into smiling, straight I wheeled a cushioned seat in front of bird and bust and door. Then upon the velvet sinking, I betook myself to linking, fancy unto fancy thinking, what this grim, ungainly, ghastly, gaunt, and ominous bird of yore meant in croaking nevermore. This I sat engaged in guessing, but no syllable expressing to the fowl whose fiery eyes now burned into my bosom's core. This and more I sat divining with my head at ease reclining on the cushion's velvet lining that the lamplight gloated o'er, but whose velvet violet lining with the lamplight gloating o'er she shall press, ah, nevermore. Then methought the air grew denser, perfume from an unseen censer, swung by seraphim whose footfalls tinkled on the tufted floor. Wretch, I cried, thy God has led thee, by these angels he has sent thee, respite, respite and nepenthe, from thy memories of Lenore. Quaff, oh, quaff this kind nepenthe, and forget this lost Lenore. Quoth the raven, nevermore. Prophet, said I, thing of evil, prophet still, if bird or devil, whether tempter sent or whether tempest tossed thee here ashore, desolate yet all undaunted, on this desert land enchanted, on this home of horror haunted, tell me truly, I implore, is there balm in Gilead? Tell me, I implore. Quoth the raven, nevermore. Prophet, said I, thing of evil, prophet still, if bird or devil, by that heaven that bends above us, by that God we both adore, tell this soul with sorrow laden, if within the days of Aden, it shall clasp a sainted maiden, whom the angels name Lenore, clasp a rare and radiant maiden, whom the angels name Lenore, quoth the raven, nevermore. Be that word our sign of parting, bird or fiend, I shrieked of starting, get thee back into the tempest and the night's plutonian shore. Leave no black plume as a token of that lie thy soul has spoken. Leave my loneliness unbroken. Quit the bust above my door. Take thy beak from out my heart and take thy form from off my door. Quoth the raven, nevermore. And the raven, never flitting, still is sitting. On the palace bust of palace, just above my chamber door. And his eyes have all the seeming of a demon that is dreaming, and the lamplight o'er him streaming throws his shadow on the floor. And my soul from out that shadow that lies floating on the floor shall be lifted nevermore. So the idea of the poem being a metaphor of grief, of how grief enters in his life to never leave again, is a valid interpretation, as valid as any other that you could come to on your own. I'm just giving you one of the possible interpretations. Going back to slide number 7, I think it was. Well, it's number 8, rather. Regarding his influences, he was an avid reader of Washington Irving and Nathaniel Hawthorne, and absolutely critical with the work of his time and the work that surrounded his lifetime. And I think I've already mentioned this. It was very common at the time for writers to be the first critics and to comment on one another's work. And we've already mentioned the fact that Herman Melville came into contact with Nathaniel Hawthorne after acclaiming his work in a very positive critic, Hawthorne and his Mosses, referring to one of the works of Nathaniel Hawthorne. Not only has he been considered the key source of the symbolist, a very direct reference for Baudelaire, and so coexistent with Hawthorne and with Melville that it becomes a very unlikely to think that neither of them had a very strong understanding and knowledge of most of his work. In the case of Melville, we can find a very direct influence of a Poe's only novel, the narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym of Nantucket. And if you remember, Nantucket is where Melville decides to place the initial point where the Pequod leaves or lifts sail in Moby Dick. So the reference and the tribute to Edgar Allan Poe is very clear in Melville's Moby Dick. The tale, the fall of of the House of Usher, is also a very interesting work that has many elements of Edgar Allan Poe. It exceeds what we can analyze in an hour and a half, And as you can see, the amount of writers that feel a direct influence and direct admiration for Poe is endless. Jules Verne considered him the father of science fiction, probably he himself being considered by most people the father of science fiction. Dostoevsky was inspired by Poe's criminal psychology. We've already mentioned something at the beginning where we were talking about Hawthorne, how the three authors are going to engage, not in this tale in particular, in creating characters with a great deal of psychological depth. Just in the poem that we just read, we can perceive an amount of psychological depth that goes beyond what we normally perceive in a poem. In the case of Dostoevsky, the criminal psychology, his likening for creating these eccentric and different characters that are so beloved, for example, in postmodernism, how this anti-hero are the heroes of Poe's tale, which sets him mostly one century ahead of his time and very inspirational, I'm sure, for many postmodernists in their early readings. His influence has been clear throughout the 20th century, despite being extremely slandered after his death by his first editor, who disapproved his temperament and his artistic methods. And the way that his first editor portrayed him was as an alcoholic and drug addict that wrote unusual and weird stories under the influence of drugs and other substances. The biased portrait that Edgar Allan Poe had at the beginning of his after his death, influenced an entire generation of readers and prevented him from having the literary recognition that he achieved 60, 70, 80 years after his death. His literary work has an undoubted debt to his own personal suffering. We see that suffering works as a way of feeding his art, and this is very common in artistic work. How suffering is seen as a catalyzer of artistic outputs. His tales were not written spontaneously, but through constant revision and built with care and precision. We've already talked about his almost mathematical method of approaching literature. I'm going to leave it there. There's so many things to talk about. I'm not even going to mention the elements of The Mask of Red Death. The Mask of Red Death is from 1842, because I want to read The Mask of Red Death, and I want you to read and understand The Mask of Red Death. I hope you have time to read it. Very close call. The Mask of Red Death on page 288. The Red Death had long devastated the country. No pestilence had ever been so fatal or so hideous. Blood was its avatar and its seal, the redness and the horror of blood. There were sharp pains and sudden dizziness, and then profuse bleeding at the pores with dissolution. The scarlet stains upon the body, especially upon the face of the victim, were the pest ban which shut him out from the aid and from the sympathy of his fellow men, and the whole seizure, progress, and termination of the disease were the incidents of half an hour. But the Prince Prospero was happy and dauntless and sagacious. When his dominions were half depopulated, he summoned to his presence 1,000 hale and light-hearted friends from among the knights and dames of the abbeys. This was an extensive and magnificent structure, the creation of the prince's own eccentric yet august taste. A strong and lofty wall girdled it in. This wall had gates of iron. The courtiers, having entered, brought furnaces and massy hammers and welded the bolts. They resolved to leave means neither of ingress or egress to the sudden impulses of despair or of frenzy from within. The abbey was amply provisioned. With such precautions, the courtiers might bid defiance to contagion. the external world to take care of itself. In the meantime, it was folly to grieve or to think. The prince had provided all the appliances of pleasure. There were buffoons, there were improvisatori, there were ballet dancers, there were musicians, there was beauty, there was wine. All these and security were within. Without was the Red Death. It was towards the close of the fifth or the sixth month of this seclusion, and while the pestilence raged most furiously abroad, that the Prince Prospero entertained his 1,000 friends at a mass ball of the most unusual magnificence. It was a voluptuous scene, that masquerade, but first let me tell of the many rooms in which it was held. There were 7, an imperial suite in many palaces, however, such suites from a long and straight vista, while the folding doors slide back nearly to the walls on either end, so that the view of the whole extent is scarcely impeded. Here the case was very different, as might have been expected from the Duke's love of the bazaar. The apartments were so irregularly disposed that the vision embraced but little more than one at a time. There was a sharp turn at every 20 or 30 yards, and at each turn a novel effect. To the right and left in the middle of each wall, a tall and narrow Gothic window looked out upon a closed corridor which pursued the windings of the suite. These windows were of stained glass, whose color varied in accordance with the prevailing hue of the decorations of the chamber into which it opens. That at the eastern extremity was hung, for example, in blue, and vividly blue were its windows. The second chamber was purple in its ornaments and tapestries, and here the panes were purple. The third was green throughout, and so were the casements. The fourth was furnished and lighted with orange, the fifth with white, the sixth with violet. The seventh apartment was closely shrouded in black velvet tapestries that hung all over the ceiling and down the walls, falling in heavy folds upon a carpet of the same material and hue. But in this chamber only, the color of the windows failed to correspond with the decorations. The panes here were scarlet, a deep blood color. Now, in no one of the 7 apartments was there any lamp or candelabrum. Amid the profusion of gold ornaments that lay scattered to and fro or depended from the roof, there was no light of any kind emanating from lamp or candle within the suite of chambers. But in the corridor that followed the suite, there stood opposite of each window a heavy tripod bearing a brazier of fire that projected its rays through the tinted glass and so glaringly illumined the room, and thus were produced a multiple of gaudy and fantastic appearances. But in the western or black chamber, the effect of the firelight that streamed upon the dark hangings through the blood-tinted panes was ghastly in extreme, and produced so wild a look upon the countenances of those who entered that there were few of the company bold enough to set foot within its precincts at all. It was in this apartment also that there stood against the western wall a gigantic clock of ebony. Its pendulum swung to and fro with a dull, heavy, monotonous clang, and when the minute hand made the circuit of the face and the hour was to be stricken, there came from the brazen lungs of the clock a sound which was clear and loud and deep and exceedingly musical, but of so peculiar a note and emphasis that at each lapse of an hour the musicians of the orchestra were constrained to pause momentarily in their performance to hearken to the sound, and thus the waltzers perforce ceased their evolution, and there was a brief disconcert of the whole gay company. And while the chimes of the clock yet rang, it was observed that the giddiest grew pale, and the more aged and sedate passed their hands over their brows as if in confused reverie or meditation. But when the echoes had fully ceased, a light laughter at once pervaded the assembly. The musicians looked at each other and smiled, as if their own nervousness and folly, and made whispering vows each to the other, that the next chiming of the clock should produce in them no similar emotion. And then, after the lapse of 60 minutes, which embraced 3,600 seconds of the time that flies, there came yet another chiming of the clock, and then were the same disconcert and tremulous and meditation as before. But in spite of these things, it was a gay and magnificent revel. The tastes of the Duke were peculiar. He had a fine eye for colors and effects. He disregarded the decorum of mere fashion. His plans were bold in fury, and his conceptions glowed with barbaric luster. There are some who would have thought him mad. His followers felt that he was not. It was necessary to hear and see and touch him to be sure that he was not. He had directed in great part the movable embellishments of the seven chambers upon occasion of this great fête, and it was his own guiding taste which had given character to the masqueraders. Be sure they were grotesque. There were much glare and glitter and piquancy and phantasm. Much of what had been seen, had been since seen in Hernani. There were arabesque figures with unsuited limbs and appointments. There were delirious fancies such as the madman fashions. There was much of the beautiful, much of the wanton, much of the bizarre, something of the terrible, and not a little of that which might have excited disgust. To and fro in the seven chambers, there stalked, in fact, a multitude of dreams, and these dreams writhed in and about, taking hue from the rooms and causing the wild music of the orchestra to seem as the echoes of their steps. And anon there strikes the ebony clock, which stands in the hall of velvet. And then for a moment, all is still and all is silent, save the voice of the clock. The dreams are stiff frozen as they stand, but the echoes of the chimes die away. They have endured but an instant, and a light, half-subdued laughter floats after them as they depart. And now again the music swells, and the dreams live, and writhe to and fro more merrily than ever, taking hue from the many-tinted windows through which stream the rays from the tripods. But to the chamber, which lies most westwardly of the seven, there are now none of the maskers who venture, for the night is waning away, and there flows a ruddier light through the blood-colored panes, and the blackness of the sable drapery appalls. And to him whose foot falls upon the sable carpet, there comes from the near clock of ebony a muffled peal more solemnly empathic than any which reaches their ears who indulge in the more remote gaieties of the other apartments. But these other apartments were densely crowded, and in them beat feverishly the heart of life. And the revel went whirlingly on until at length there commenced the sound of the midnight upon the clock. And then the music ceased, as I have told, and the evolutions of the waltzers were quieted. And there was an uneasy cessation of all things as before. But now there were 12 strokes to be sounded by the bell of the clock. And thus it happened, perhaps the more of thought crept with more of time into the meditations of the thoughtful among those who reveled. And thus, too, it happened, perhaps, that before the last echoes of the last chime had utterly sunk into silence, there were many individuals in the crowd who had found leisure to become aware of the presence of a masked figure which had arrested the attention of no single individual before. And the rumor of this new presence having spread itself whisperingly around, there arose at length from the whole company a buzz or murmur expressive of disapprobation and surprise, and finally of terror, of horror, and of disgust. In an assembly of phantasms such as I have painted, it may well be supposed that no ordinary appearance could have excited such sensation. In truth, the masquerade license of the night was nearly unlimited, but the figure in question had out-heroded Herod and gone beyond the bounds of even the prince's indefinite decorum. There are chords in the heart of the most reckless which cannot be touched without emotion. Even with the utterly lost, to whom life and death are equally jest, there are matters of which no jest can be made. The world, the whole company, indeed, seem now deeply to feel that in the figure, that in the costume and bearing of the stranger, neither wit nor propriety existed. The figure was tall and gaunt, and shrouded from head to foot in the habiliments of the grave. The mask which concealed the visage was made so nearly to resemble the countenance of a stiffened corpse that the closest scrutiny must have had difficulty in detecting the cheat. And yet all this might have been endured, if not approved, by the mad revelers around. But the mummer had gone so far as to assume the type of the Red Death. His vesture was dabbed in blood, and his broad brow, with all the features of the face, was besprinkled with the scarlet horror. When the eyes of Prince Prospero fell upon this spectral image, which with a slow and solemn movement, as if more fully to sustain its role, stalked to and fro among the waltzers, he was seen to be convulsed in the first moment with a strong shudder, either of terror or distaste. But in the next, his brow reddened with rage. "Who dares," he demanded hoarsely, of the courtiers who stood near him, "who dares insult us with this blasphemous mockery? Seize him and unmask him, that we may know whom we have to hang at sunrise from the battlements." It was an eastern or blue chamber in which it stood the Prince Prospero as he uttered these words. They rang throughout the seven rooms loudly and clearly, for the prince was a bold and robust man, and the music had become hushed at the waving of his hand. It was in the blue room where stood the prince with a group of pale courtiers by his side. At first, as he spoke, there was a slight rushing movement of this group in direction of the intruder, who at the moment was also near at hand, and now, with deliberate and stately step, made closer approach to the speaker. But from a certain nameless awe with which the mad assumptions of the mummer had inspired the whole party, there were found none who put forth hand to seize him, so that unimpeded he passed within a yard of the prince's person. And while the vast assembly, as if with one impulse, shrank from the centers of the room to the walls, he made his way uninterruptedly, but with the same solemn and measured step which had distinguished him from the first, through the blue chamber to the purple, through the purple to the green to the orange, through this again to the white, and even thence to the violet, ere a decided movement had been made to arrest him. It was then, however, that the Prince Prospero, maddening with rage and the shame of his own momentary cowardice, rushed hurriedly through the six chambers, while none followed him on account of a deadly terror that had seized upon all. He bore aloft a drawn dagger, and had approached in rapid impetuosity to within 3 or 4 feet of the retreating figure, when the latter, having attained the extremity of the velvet apartment, turned suddenly and confronted his pursuer. There was a sharp cry, and the dagger dropped gleaming upon the sable carpet, upon which instantly afterwards fell prostrate in death the Prince Prospero. Then summoning the wild courage of despair, a throng of the revelers at once threw themselves into the black apartment, and seizing the mummer, whose tall figure stood erect and motionless within the shadow of the ebony clock, gasped in unutterable horror at finding the grave cerements and corpse-like mask, which they handled with so violent rudeness, untenanted by any tangible form. And now was acknowledged the presence of the Red Death. He had come like a thief in the night, and one by one dropped the revelers in the blood-bedewed halls of their revel, and died each in the despairing posture of his fall. And the life of the ebony clock went out with that of the last of the gay, and the flames of the tripods expired, and the darkness and decay and the Red Death held illimitable dominion over all. Okay, so that's your story. We'll comment on it next week. I've already consumed 4 minutes of the next class. I'm going to have to cut that short. The party seems worth, is that the desired effect? Well, it's an effect, yes, for sure. I'll answer your questions by email, Constance, because I just don't want to take up the time of the next teacher. I'm very sorry that this unit is especially challenging to complete.